Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Today after the meal, there was a group of Thai people came who were interested in practice. And then at tea time, there's a couple of sisters from Aranyabodhi. One of the things that I was talking about, and I thought it would be worth exploring a bit further this evening, is just the underlying qualities that we want to be bringing to our practice. Not so much particular technique or method, because oftentimes we think of the Buddha's teachings or our spiritual practice as a say as a problem of technology. If I had the right technology, then I'd be able to crack this problem. So we look for the right technique, we look for the right method, we look for the right sort of just the right trick that would make it all sort of change, and I wouldn't have any suffering anymore. I think what's more important to be reflecting on something a bit broader, deeper, systemic. And this is, I think, something that Ajahn Chah in particular really embodied or exemplified. Because he would teach all sorts of different techniques and methods, and it wasn't he was open to just about anything so long as it worked, and increased what was wholesome, decreased what was unwholesome, increased well-being and decreased suffering, and certainly the Buddha. There's a set of teachings that or a set of qualities that the Buddha applied to many different teachings. So that whether it was the development of the Eightfold Path, Seven Factors of Enlightenment, Five Spiritual Faculties, Four Bases of Success, he would come back and emphasize, these are the four qualities that you need to cultivate each factor of those particular sets of teachings. In Pali, viveka, viraga, nirodha, vosaka, and say in English, solitude, seclusion, withdrawal. That's viveka. Viraga is dispassion, fading away. Nirodha, cessation. Vosaka, relinquishment. So these are the qualities. So whatever practice we're picking up, or whatever kind of set of tools that we're picking up in our training, we have to pay attention to the kind of attitude behind it, the qualities of heart that we bring to it. And that's I think what is probably far more important than even, well, it's hard to separate the two really, certainly that sense of, but what kind of quality of heart are we bringing to our practice? Because there is a tendency to think that if I just sort of say, line up all these different factors of the path, there are these enlightenment factors, and if I just sort of get all my ducks in a row, get them all working, then somehow something magical is going to happen. We also need to pay attention to how we're holding the practice. So this sense of viveka, a quality of solitude, withdrawal, seclusion. A sense of stepping back to that entanglement with both in terms of the external impressions, external sense contact, as well as the internal moods and reactions and proliferations that can easily manifest because of that. So that the sense of being able to withdraw, to be able to have a sense of inner seclusion. It's like having an inner anchor or inner base a base of clarity, base of mindfulness, base of stability that we can work from or protect ourselves with, as opposed to leaping in and getting swept up with the likes and dislikes towards the world, or the delight and dejection toward the world. It's so often what the impulse is. So this sense of seclusion, and it isn't Ajahn Sumedho, when he went to England, living in London before they got the monastery in outside the city, there was something that he reflected on a lot, in that especially the being out of the context of a forest monastery, northeast Thailand, couldn't have been further from that. Thinking that, he's not going to experience the same kind of seclusion, external seclusion, so that it has to be an internal seclusion. And so the Buddha speaks of this directly, there is, say, kaya viveka, the seclusion of the body, external seclusion, the seclusion of, say, circumstance, a physical circumstance. But there's also citta viveka, the seclusion of the heart, so that there can be a engagement with the world, engagement with duties, engagement with with the senses, but the heart is secluded. There's a peacefulness within the heart. There's there's an internal seclusion, withdrawal, solitude. Because often we're either, relying on the external in order to have affirmation for ourselves, support for ourselves, having and of course it has its effect. I mean, and one doesn't just sort of go out looking for negative influences to see how secluded the mind can be, but but I'm just really paying attention to how do I contact the world, and not be unduly influenced, and when I say the world, it doesn't mean we have to go down to San Francisco every day to practice. It's not, as we can do the world is the world of the senses. And even living in the monastery, we're impacted by the world. In that sense, we experience the sight, sound, smells, taste, touch, mental formations. And and impressions are formed from that, so that that's a great sort of quote from the early days of Wat Bapong Wat Nanachat Waraponyo, where that they said that's when you're living in the monastery and living with other people, then it's very easy to get the feeling that at least 80% of all the suffering in the world is because of the person sitting next to you. That is not citta viveka. that getting caught in the but this is what happens. Our mind forms. It's likes, it's dislikes, it's impressions, and we don't withdraw. We get entangled. So this sense of viveka is very important to be cultivating consciously. And then, of course, then the Buddha goes on from citta viveka, because the citta viveka is like the seclusion of the heart through sense restraint, through the mindfulness, through meditation, there becomes a stability and a strength of the heart. But then there's a upadhi viveka, which is a the upadhi is like the basis of being, the basis of the formulation of the sense of personality, of identity, it's our fundamental, movement of mind, based on clinging and attachment to the five khandhas, that keeps propping up that sense of me, the sense of mine, the sense of this is myself. So that learning how to, and of course this is insight and wisdom practice. So realizing, okay, there's a, just in developing viveka as an attitude, that in itself is a huge piece of the practice. Not just sort of how do I shut myself away and not have to deal with anybody anymore. It's like I was mentioning at tea time a monk who went to live with Ajahn Chah early years. He'd practiced and trained at another monastery. He was quite a very gifted, very adept at samadhi practice. Not at all difficult to enter jhana and in whatever posture, and the mind just be in strong concentration and stability for hours at a time, any posture. And you know, it's amazing. And but then he went and lived. He was living in solitude, or maybe a cave or something, because the way that Ajahn Chah said it, because he came and spent a bit of time with Ajahn Chah. And so he said, "Well, you can, and the monk was trying to decide whether he should go back into solitude or should he stay and continue to study with Ajahn Chah. Ajahn Chah said, "Well, you can go back to your cave and learn how to be peaceful there, or you can stay here and learn how to be peaceful anywhere." and of course the monk chose to stay with Ajahn Chah. Because we have to learn how to carry that viveka with us. We have to learn how to embody that viveka. And it isn't through just fending the world off and protecting my turf of silence. And it's a clear seeing that understands the nature of the external sense world, the internal sense world of our what we react to, how we what's our default option when it comes to seeing something that we perceive as pleasant? What's our default option when we experience something that is unpleasant? How can we be secluded from that? How can we be withdrawn from that? Doesn't mean we don't have any feelings, but it's that laying that foundation of viveka. So this is it's an important skill and quality to be bringing to any aspect of our practice, whether it's the aspects of sila and our development of the precepts, the samadhi practice or meditation, mindfulness, the banya, right, the discernment and understanding that we're cultivating. How do we bring in these qualities. So that viveka is an important aspect. The second quality that the Buddha emphasizes is viraka, which is, say, quite literally, dispassion, as a translation of the word. It has a related meaning and or alternative meaning of fading away. So this dispassion is a cooling of the heart. Just not getting caught in the things that really stir up the passions, and whether it's passions of desire and attachment, or it's the passions of aversion and or fear, that quality of dispassion is essential, so that we step back from, we're able to step back from that that sense of getting stirred up, getting caught, and being able to let those reactions fade away. It's like the very well known story of Ajahn Chah having his palms read by a palmist, a fortune teller, and the fortune teller being kind of shocked and kind of surprised, looking at the, and of course fortune tellers and palmists are incredibly popular in Thailand, fortune telling in any way, shape or form, let's say, looking at Ajahn Chah and say, "Oh, by the lines in your hand, it looks like you've got a lot of anger." And Ajahn Chah just sort of smiling, "Yes, but I don't pick it up. There's dispassion." There's a similar story with another very famous monk, disciple of Ajahn Mun. Senior disciple of Ajahn Mun, his name is Lumpu Dun, and when I've met him on many occasions, very very sweet monk, and he was already quite elderly then, probably late 60s, 70s, and he was asked by a it was actually, I think it was another monk who was getting really serious about his practice, like a scholar, academic monk, and asking, "Oh, do you still have any anger?" And it was sort of like, because he's reputed to be an arahant, the monk was kind of looking for affirmation or said, "Do you still have any anger?" And his response, he said, "Yeah, I have it, but I don't receive it." And so I don't meet in my owl, which is a Thai sometimes is wonderfully simple and direct. Meet in my owl, and so like I have it, but I don't take it, you know, you think, "Well, how can that be?" But it's that quality of, viveka, viraka. the viveka, the viraka, our soul, that's the default option. Habits of the mind are just habits of the mind. Temperament we might have built up over, you know, who knows how many lifetimes. But the building that realizing that we have the option, and that option can be internalized and stabilized. Viraka, dispassion, fading away. We look to the fading away, look to the cooling of things. And so of course the world is there externally, world is there internally. It's sort of, it's there, but it's kind of not there, right? Because we don't have to react to it. We can respond with compassion, we can respond with wisdom, but we don't have to react out of our likes and dislikes. We don't have to react out of our greed, hatred, and delusion. We always have that option. So this strengthening that, giving that importance, recognizing that those are that's always a possibility, and that we have to imbue our practice and our being with these qualities. Solitude, dispassion. And dispassion isn't dismissing. Because that's aversion, where that sort of I hate that, I don't like that, I'm going to be dispassionate. that's not dispassion, that's aversion. But it's sort of seeing that clearly. It's okay if I react out of attachment and according to my likes and dislikes. I just it keeps stirring the mind up. But there's this other option of dispassion, of fading away, letting it cool, letting it settle, letting it just. That it has its own kind of nature, and one doesn't choose it. One chooses that which is leading to the end of suffering, and that's the wise option, and we can do that. And as we do that, the more we do that, the more we make that clear. Then, of course, that's what the mind actually does. We were talking about that earlier today, Ajahn Kurunda, what one thinks becomes one's inclination within the mind. So that's how the mind works. So that inclining to viveka, inclining to viraga, it becomes the inclination, it becomes the default option. And then we can release anything else, or especially the sense of nirodha, that sense of cessation. There's many aspects of looking at this quality of nirodha, of cessation, of ending. On a very straightforward level, everything is arising and ceasing, coming into being and ending. And what usually grabs our attention is what the arising of things, It's kind of exciting. It's something that's happening. And we often forget to pay attention to the ceasing, the ending. And when we do pay attention to that ceasing, that ending, there's a real cooling and settling that takes place. It's like just in terms of like mindfulness of breathing. Breathing in, breathing out. You know, distracting thoughts, you know, well, during the meditation almost invariably come up. We're mindful. I'm a meditator. I'm a mindful meditator. I'll breathe in. And somewhere along the way, we forget. And then the mind starts wandering. But it's usually not, say, at the beginning of an in-breath or the beginning of an out-breath. It's more, you know, especially as the mind, the breath actually slows down. And that process, the body becomes a bit calmer. We're not really attentive all the way through. But when we're attentive and stay with that ending of the in-breath and the arising of the out-breath, the ending of the out-breath, the arising of the in-breath, there's a clarity and a sharpness that comes, because it's the cessation of things we get bored with. Mm-hmm. It's just the nature of the mind. We get easily distracted with. We don't recognize the import of that reality. So to pay attention to the ending of things, and especially in the terms of thoughts and feelings, to really pay attention to the end of a thought, when a thought process, a kind of a train of thought that is, even if it's obsessing about something, can we pay attention to that thought and watch it cease? And this incredible release takes place then. It's like driving a wedge into that obsessive nature of the mind and opening up a possibility of peace and clarity. And it's just by paying attention to cessation. Now that. So that, I mean, that's on a very straightforward level of approaching this quality of cessation. It has the of course Nirodha is also a kind of like a synonym. It's used as a synonym for the ending of suffering, and to pay attention to. You know, do we have to suffer all the time? Are we that benighted? And recognizing, well, not at all. Why do we identify with our suffering, our dis-ease, our discontent, our dissatisfaction? Why is it so perversely interesting to be miserable? But we do it. I mean, actually, we're quite adept at it. But it's okay. We can shift our attention to something else. That's cessation. Another aspect of cessation, particularly within the causal processes of dependent origination, because dependent origination is both a process of more like dependent co-arising, because it's not just about the arising of phenomena, but it's also about cessation of phenomena and the arising of suffering, cessation of suffering. But the problem is that some of its language, where, because when we say cessation, it's like something quite concrete that concretely begins, concretely ends. But it also can mean to, and just as valid a translation, sort of like cease to be a problem. Say, when feeling ceases to be a problem, tanha, as a desire, ceases to be a problem. When desire ceases to be a problem, attachment ceases to be a problem. And it really opens things up, because that sense of perceiving problems all around us. It's like, remember one time Ajahn Chah, he was defining what was a human being. What's a human being? What's the nature of human beings? Ajahn Chah was human beings are beings that create issues, create problems. And so that's what we're good at. But then the sense, the alternative is is supporting, inclining, strengthening that option for cessation. So to recognize that these are all things we have to make conscious. Making that viveka conscious, vilaka conscious, niroda conscious. It's bringing that, clarifying it, understanding its possibilities. And the last quality of vosaka is relinquishment. And relinquishment from this sense of vosaka is more a relinquishment of self. It encompasses relinquishment as a principle of releasing, letting go, putting down the burden of attachment. But it's also the core of it, from the perspective of vosaka or relinquishment, is the relinquishment of that sense of the I, the me, the mind principle, that sense of self. That's what keeps collecting, keeps hoarding, keeps trying to accumulate and acquire, whether it's acquiring material things or acquiring experiences or accumulating what makes us feel secure and comfortable. There's a relinquishment that is necessary in order for us to really be free, in order for us to really be peaceful, so that to be attending to that cultivation of relinquishment, and to not propping up the sense of self, the sense of me trying to get somewhere in my practice, me trying to get rid of something in my practice. On a conventional level, we've got certain things we need to be cultivating and developing. Cultivate the wholesome, develop the wholesome, develop what is skillful. There's things we need to let go of, to get rid of on a course level, but relinquishing the unwholesome. But it's also on a deeper level that the relinquishment of wosaka is a relinquishment of self. Relinquishment of identity. There's a very beautiful exchange between. It's in from the Deva Samyutta, so it's these conversations and. Between the Buddha and devas, and because oftentimes the devas would come and say, ask for guidance, in the same way that other religious seekers or lay people in the society would come and. Ask for guidance from the Buddha, then devas will show up and ask for guidance. And sometimes it was testing and understanding that they had. So this one deva comes and he's got a practitioner, and sort of speaking as in terms of what the ideal. Trying to refresh it in my mind, but it's something like the mindful meditator diligently wanders and practices for the relinquishment of all sense desire. Which is, to a certain degree, that's obviously what we need to be doing. But then the Buddha repeats it in the sense, kind of word by word. But wanders mindfully for the relinquishment of self-identity. Because that's really the core of what we need to relinquish. I mean, and then sense desire, aversions, delusions, they'll fall away. They'll drop away on their own. But the thing that keeps it fed, keeps it nourished, keeps it quite happy and comfortable is that self-identity, the sense of that I, me, and mine. So that paying attention to relinquishment around that sense of relinquishment of self, which is not a self-abnegation, it's not a self trying to squash a sense of any kind of like oftentimes mention of when I was still living in Thailand as the abbot there, and somebody writing a letter wanting to come to practice it at Wat Nanachat, take ordination. They wrote this long letter, and it's just, the whole thing was written with no personal pronouns. So. You know, there's so much self in trying to write a letter with no personal pronouns. It's idealized. It's not recognized. So that there's this wosaka, relinquishment of self. There's a freedom there that understands nature of suffering and cessation of suffering. So that using these qualities of seclusion, dispassion, cessation, relinquishment, to inform, instruct all the different areas of one's practice, the cultivation of the Eightfold Path, right view through to right concentration, factors of enlightenment, mindfulness through to equanimity, factors of spiritual faculties, faith through to wisdom. These are that informing, instructing, imbuing your practice with these qualities. And, you know, when you're... And so that rather than get... tying yourself up in knots in how to get the... say the precepts exactly right, or how to get the technicalities of mindfulness of breathing exactly right. How do you approach it? How do you hold it? So that holding the practice with these qualities of heart, and then you'll find the practice really goes smoothly. Really, the one will really experience the fruits of practice as one experiments and understands and reflects from that perspective. So I'll offer that for your reflection this evening.